I'm Wayne, I'm an alcoholic. You know, he told me before the meeting, this is a fast-moving train, so if I was going to pray, to do it real quick, because you guys won't do a whole lot of pre-stuff before the meeting starts. First, I want to thank you for asking me to do this. It is a privilege to get to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not going to lie to you, this is probably one of my least favorite things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe it or not, it is. It is. But, you know, I was taught to say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. Say yes. And I'll start by giving you my sobriety date. My home group sponsor tells me I'm supposed to do that. My sobriety date is September the 13th, 1991, and that's through the grace of God and the generosity of a lot of people in AA, you know, that I'm even standing here. And my home group is the Closed Circle and Easy Does It group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet in historical Hampton, Virginia, on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock at 807 West Mercury Boulevard, and Sunday nights at 7:30 at that same location. The Thursday night meeting is a closed meeting for alcoholics only. Sunday night meeting is an open meeting, and it's usually larger, and it's been nicknamed the ice cream meeting because we have ice cream there spring, summer, winter, and fall. Right? Get there early or you may not get any, you know. I found out drunks will eat ice cream with snow on the ground. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. You know, I always like to open up with a quick little story about something that I, you know, did in my childhood or whatever. And it kind of, I guess, describes how I was. Boy, this is keeping it, you know, we hope you don't find this in bad taste. I hope you don't find what I'm about to say in bad taste either, right? But you know, when I was a kid, my grandmother would send us, you know, every Easter, she would send us these Easter bunnies. And I'm talking like in the 60s, right? So, you know, they were like this tall, and they were solid chocolate all the way through. Not this hollow stuff that they're trying to pass off now, right? And I remember when we got them, and I mean, I was excited. And the first thing my mother said, she looked at me, she said, "Boy, don't you eat all that chocolate," right? So my little mind's working already. So long story short, the feet were left. I ate it down to the feet, right? And she just kind of looked at me, and I said, "Well, you told me not to eat all of it, and I didn't. The feet are left." You know, that didn't go over too well. It didn't. And see, this was back in the day when you could actually still beat your children, right? Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. And my mother, we call her the general, she firmly believed in applying the Board of Education to the seat of learning. You know, yes. Oh, yeah. But, you know, that was a loophole. And, I mean, that just kind of describes, you know, me. You know, always looking for that, you know, a way to beat the system or whatever. And just an FYI, the only way I have found to actually beat the system is to stay out of it. Right? Yeah. Ever since I've stayed out of the system, I've managed to beat it, right? You know, my parents, they were young when they had us. By the time my mother was 20, she had already had all three of us. And there's a little joke that they used to say that my mother and father and I were at their senior prom together, you know. And that was true. You know, so we kind of grew up together, I guess you could say. And, you know, my dad was a great, I mean, just one of the best athletes to come out of our area. In the, back in the 60s, he actually was offered a contract to play quarterback for the Bears. That's how good he was. And that's a big deal in the 60s for a black man to get offered a contract to play quarterback. Not running back or tight end. Quarterback, right? And he, got caught up in a whole bunch of stuff, wine, women, and song, and et cetera, and that never came to fruition. And, you know, a lot of the memories I have about my dad aren't real good. You know, they really aren't. And it wasn't until I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, got sober in AA that I was actually able to make my peace with him and everything. And, you know, today I can tell you that I love my father. I know he wasn't the ideal, you know, father knows best kind of dad, but I guess he was doing the best that he could with what he had at the time, which, trust me, the bar wasn't set real high either. It wasn't. And, you know, my parents split up when we were really, really young. And you know, some of the things that I remembered, you know, about my dad, there would always be a lot of people at our house, right? And I noticed these guys, you know, these guys had these nice cars, nice clothes, and had these pretty women with them, have all this money and stuff. That's what I wanted. I wanted to be like that. And I noticed there would be two card tables. One would be full of money, and the other one would be full of, I was just, for lack of a better term, non-conference approved substance. Okay? Which, that's part of my story as well, but out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm not going to dwell on that. But if there is somebody in here who's had that problem too, I can tell you that, you know, I found my answer in Alcoholics Anonymous and in the 12 steps, you know. But anyway, I had saw my father OD twice, and I would have to go up, run up the street, get somebody, get one of his friends to help bring him back around. And there was a part of me that really wanted to let him die, you know, because I hated the man. I had absolutely no use for him. You know, he was abusive, you know, to my mother. And I remember saying, when I ever got to an age where I could get him out of there, he was gone. And that day did come. And I spent a lot of years resenting him, you know, for that. And like I said, once I came in here and, you know, got busy working on Wayne, you know, like I was supposed to, I made peace with him. Behavioral problems started before I picked up a drink or non-conference approved substance. I will remember being in the third grade, and back then we had kind of skates that went over your shoe, you know, to have a skate key for. And this kid just kept picking on me, kept bothering me. So I just sat there and methodically took that skate apart, and I smacked him right across his face with it, 44 stitches to sew his face up. And I remember not going to the principal's office that day. I remember going downtown. And my parents were separated at the time, and they showed up together, which was kind of a uh-oh. And then they were agreeing on what to do to me, which they never agreed on anything. And I'm like, oh, man, you know, I was almost begging them to keep me there instead of having to go home with them. And like I said, back then, that was back in the age where, you know, the old Board of Education, see the learning thing, you know. And, you know, the following year, I got into some more trouble. I got into a fight with a kid in our class. He was a bully, you know, so I felt kind of justified at, you know, fighting him and everything. And I told him, I said, if I get you next to that window, you're going out. And we managed to tussle, and I got him at the window, and out he went. And this was like three stories up. And the only reason he didn't die is because he landed in bushes. And, I mean, he was a kid. You know, kids are resilient, you know. And I didn't go to the principal's office that day either, right? I went straight downtown. And my parents showed up again together. I'm like, oh, God, this is, oh, man, not again. And they were nodding in unison, you know, agreeing on what to do to me. And I was like, man, I would rather them keep me here than I have to go back home and face that. And, I mean, they came up with a brilliant idea, which I guess seemed like a good idea at the time. They figured since I had this pent-up whatever it was, that I should channel it in a positive way, so they enrolled me in martial arts. So now I'm skilled and crazy, right? Beautiful combination, right? Great combination. You know, and it wasn't too long after that that I discovered the beauty of alcohol and non-conference approved substances, for lack of a better term. And I remember the first time that I intentionally, you know, set out to do that, we'd snuck a couple of bottles of Ripple, which was real popular back then, and some Bally High wine, and some couple of, I'm going to say, sticks of non-conference approved substance. And when I did that, I just knew right then and there that I wanted to feel like that all the time. I mean, I just knew it. And this was in 1968, and I spent the next 23 years chasing how I felt right then and never caught up with it again, and almost died in the process more than once trying to catch up with how I felt that day. I think one of the only saving graces that I had was that I was always a good student, but I always made really good grades. And, you know, I was real good in sports, and I started playing music right about that time, too. So I was, you know, I was real good at those things. And they would kind of, you know, school would kind of excuse, you know, some of my behaviors, you know, because I was really good at what I did, and, you know, I made good grades. And that seemed to be a common theme for me pretty much throughout my life until everything just kind of fell apart on me. I managed to get through, through school as far as, you know, making good grades and everything and playing sports and, you know, being in the band and all of that. And I had become quite popular, you know, surprise, surprise, right? And, you know, I hear a lot of people say that they had a hard time fitting in, but I could fit in with a number of different, you know, groups. You know, I could do that chameleon thing that we are so good at. You know, I fit in with the smart kids because, you know, I made good grades. You know, I fit in with the jocks because I was one too. You know, I fit in with the musicians because I was one of them. And then I had gotten the bright idea of how to kind of supplement my income. You know, bullies, there was no shortage of bullies in any of the schools I went to. And they would always pick on, you know, usually kids that were smaller than them or whatever. So I said, well, wow, he beat you up and took your money, huh? Yeah, I said, well, how much did he take? $10. I'm like, wow, you know what? I'll tell you what. You give me $3, and I can guarantee that will never happen to you again. Right? So I started my own little, you know, keeping the bullies away from the, you know, kids that they were beating up and stuff, man, you know. And I thought I was doing a service. I really did. I thought I was doing a service, not knowing that that's actually a form of bullying itself. It really is. But I didn't know it. I thought I was protecting the scared, nerdy kids that wouldn't stand up to them. And somehow I was found out, you know, about that, and I was told in uncertain terms that I wouldn't be doing that. You know, I didn't know that was extortion. I know that, right? Well, I'm in school. What do I know? You know, what do I know about that kind of stuff, right? But anyway, I managed, you know, to get through school. Like I would get in trouble. I would do things or whatever. And they got smart because they found out real quick that I wasn't really afraid of the principal or the assistant principal. So they got smart and would either send me to the coach or send me to the band director. And I would much rather have gone to the principal, had to go to either one of those two. And believe it or not, the one who I feared the most was my band director, you know. And boy, yeah, this guy, he did not play. He really didn't. And he was really largely responsible for me getting in college and for me getting a band scholarship. So, you know, high school was great and everything. And by the time it was time for me to actually go to high school, see, we lived in California, and we lived in New York, and we came here, back here, because this is where my parents were from, and this is where I was born at, too, in Newport News. And when we came back here, you know, after living in the places that I lived, I looked around, I mean, I'm thinking, oh, my God, we are in the land that time forgot, right? I mean, that's what it felt like to me. It really did. You know, I remember watching Green Acres on TV and stuff, and I'm like, oh, God, now we're actually living it, right? Oh, man. As soon as I can get out of here, I am, right? And, you know, when I went to college, I went on a full scholarship and it paid for all 4 years, and I actually graduated with a 3.75 GPA. Now, I can tell you honestly that almost every single day I was down there, I was either drinking or doing some non-conference approved whatever. And I can probably count on one hand the entire 4 years in the summer I spent down there that I drew a sober breath. I'm serious. You know, a lot of it is a blur to me. And I got in trouble there the same way I did in school and in high school and everything. Got arrested a few times, and they would always threatened to take my scholarship from me. You know, back then, things were a lot different than they are now, because if you sneeze wrong now and you're on a scholarship, they will snatch it quick, real quick. And they, one of the last times I really got into major trouble, they threatened to call the general, which is what we call my mother. And, you know, to this day, that woman still strikes the fear of God in me. Oh, she does. She really does. And, but, you know, I had actually met a girl that I got serious about down there, because most of the time I was down there, I wasn't really that serious about anybody. And that school, as far as ratio of women to men, it was like 5 women to 1 man. So I never had to type a term paper. You know, I would get somebody to do that for me. And I didn't actually learn how to type until probably about 12 years ago, I think. 12, 13 years ago, yeah. And it was only because of the field that I'm in now, being in information technology, I have to. You know, I have to know how to do that. And, you know, I met this girl, and, you know, we had gotten pretty serious. And it was time for me to graduate. And my plan at that time was to save up some money, go to graduate school, right? Well, I went down and stayed with her and her family for a while, and was working at this company, Export Leaf Tobacco Company was the name of it. Anyway, I'm sitting there working the third shift, and I had maybe had a couple, you know, before I went in. And I'm sitting there, my job was just to use this power stapler and put, you know, put the labels on the boxes. Well, I might have nodded off a little bit. You know, I would have told them I was inspecting my eyelids for cracks or praying or something, right? And I heard this, poof. And then I looked down and I had to staple my fingers together, one of those big power staples. It didn't hurt until I looked at it. And then I'm screaming and freaking out and everything, and I'm like, you know, get it out, get it out. So they finally took me down to the hospital, and they took it out. Why they didn't, you know, give me a breathalyzer or any of that, I don't know. You know, because I could have probably gotten into more trouble for that. But anyway, I was, you know, the girl and I, we started talking about some things, and her parents were starting to push this marriage thing, right? I said, well, okay, here's what I'm going to have to do. I need to go home and talk to my folks about this, right? You know, because I want them to be in on it too. And this was in 1980. And I hadn't been back down there since, other than to go, like, to conferences and stuff. But I have made amends to her, you know, whatever, you know, since coming into AA. And I got into some more trouble. And I remember standing in front of the judge, and he just kind of looked, and I knew it was going to be a bad day in court for me when the first words out of his mouth was, "You again?" So I tell you what, this is the last time I'm going to see you in my courtroom. I'm going to give you a choice. Since you like to fight so much, you can either go fight for your country, or I will send you back where you just came from. And that was not a real hard choice for me to make, and I credit the judge with putting me in the Army. You know, back then they used to do that. They did. And I was facing 30 years, right? And it was contingent on me finishing up a certain amount of time in the Army. Otherwise, I was going to get all 30 of those years. And I was never one of those that was on the catch and release program. They would catch and keep with me, you know. And I didn't know you could actually get more time while you're in jail until that happened to me. I didn't know they could do that. You know, I'm thinking him in jail already. You know, what else can they do? They can do more. Trust me, they can. And so I joined the Army, and back then, if you didn't like what the drill said to you or whatever, you could actually go out back and settle it with them, right? And by this time, I hadn't really had anything in me, and I was used to putting, you know, booze and other stuff in me by this time. And, well, it had been a period of time where I hadn't. And I was starting not to feel real good. And I think it started to reflect in my attitude. Okay. Yeah. So one day he tells us to do something. I didn't say anything. I just kind of looked at him. And see, what was funny to me was a lot of these guys, they would be screaming at him. They'd be crying and losing their bodily functions and whatnot, you know. And I'm just standing there looking at him, you know, laughing. It was funny to me because I'm thinking, what can you do to me, dude? I just came out of jail to here, all right, you know. So, I mean, what? What? Right? And that was my attitude. He finally said, oh, you don't like it? Fine, we can go out back and settle it. I'm like, your funeral. So we go out back, and by this time, I'm a second-degree black belt. Apparently, he hadn't read all the way through my jacket. And it didn't take me long to lay him out either. It really didn't. And one of the other drills saw it, and he was like, impressed about how you handle yourself. I said, oh, now you want some, huh? And I was hoping he would say no, because this guy was probably almost as wide as one of those doors. And I said, no. You ever thought about going to Special Forces? I'm like, what do they do? And he told me a little bit. I said, do they drink? He said, yeah. I said, do they chase women? He said, yeah. I said, do they catch any? He said, yeah. I said, where do I sign? And I had a fear of heights. Okay? I had a fear of heights. And the first school they sent me to was jump school. That wasn't pretty the first time. It really wasn't. It really, really wasn't. And, you know, my plan was just to do my minimum time, get those 30 years off me, you know, and get out and go to graduate school. Well, Army had other ideas. And said, oh, you're a college graduate, huh? I tell you what, here's what we can do for you. And, you know, I couldn't tell them no because they knew I had to do whatever they told me because they knew about the 30 years I was facing. They said, we're going to give you a, we're going to put some bars on your shoulders and we're going to give you your own team to lead. Really? Really? You're going to do that? And I said, well, you know, I mean, I ain't got too much choice. I got to do what you asked me, you know, so yeah, all right. And, you know, I wound up, you know, being a team leader. And we got into a whole lot of stuff, and I mean, they would excuse so much of our behavior and my behavior, the bar fights and all of that stuff. And I mean, my commanding officer, he would come get me out of jail, you know. And matter of fact, the last time he showed up to get me out, he had his bedroom slippers on and bathrobe, and he wasn't real happy either about it. And he said, if I don't make general because of you, I will come find you. And this dude looked like John Wayne, so I believed him. I really did. I mean, I continued to get into trouble. I mean, and it seems like every time I got in trouble, booze was involved, either directly or indirectly. And, I mean, we had, I had the opportunity to really, really, really see the ugly side of humanity, you know, doing that too. You know, I did. And that was just even more of an excuse for me to drink more and to do other stuff more. And I had gotten to a point where I was starting to burn out on it, and they could kind of tell, too. So they said, well, you got a music degree, so what we'll do is we'll go ahead and make you a bandmaster, right? Now, I'm going from, yeah, I mean, it was like a night and day difference. It was night and day difference. Now, they're going to take somebody that was doing the stuff that I was doing and put them in a ceremonial unit. And I found out real quick that they kind of frown on bar fights and that stuff. You know, they're just not into that kind of thing. And I can recall times where we would be at the officers' club, a party for the general, and I have run out of, you know, what I thought I needed to have. And I'm in these full, not just the dress blues, but the ones with the short little jacket, the little dining in things, your medals clinking all together and whatnot. And I left, and I went downtown to get some non-conference approved substance. And I didn't think the guy gave me what I thought I should have had, so I got him by the throat screaming at him. And I'm in dining in dress blues downtown acting like that, right, which seemed perfectly normal to me. It did. And, you know, it had gotten to a point where the Army was starting to get a little, you know, tired of me. But I had fulfilled my obligation to not get them 30 years. I wasn't that stupid, right? And during that process of being, you know, being in the Army, I got married, and I figured because she didn't drink or anything, that would be more for me, and one of us would be able to at least, you know, steer the ship or whatever, right? And she had finally gotten to a point after 6 years where she fired me as a husband. And, you know, good for her, too. Good for her. Had two daughters, you know, out of that marriage. And I think the straw that broke the camel's back with that marriage, I had told her I was going to go to the store and get some milk and bread. I'll be back. And about 2 weeks later, I'm calling her from Columbia, South, you know, not Columbia, South Carolina, Columbia, you know, to wire me some money to get me out of jail. And I wasn't down there picking coffee beans with Juan Valdez either. Okay, that wasn't the purpose for the trip. You know, she hung up on me. I mean, after all the sacrifices I made for her, she hung up on me. And when I finally got home, I said, oh, better stop by the store first. So I did. Got the milk and the bread. Yeah. Tried my key. It didn't work. Right? I'm like, what's wrong with this key, you know? So I'm knocking on the door, you know, and I'm, why did you change the locks, you know? And why is my stuff all gathered up right there, right? And I said I would be back. Here's the bread and milk, just like I said, right? But see, there I go with that loophole thing again. I never gave a time frame on when I was coming back, okay? Just like I ate that chocolate bunny down to the feet. I didn't eat all of it. Didn't eat it all, right? So, you know, in my mind, I hadn't really done anything wrong. Okay? My wife said, yeah, he's still like that. Yeah. Well, she had gotten tired of me, and you know, the Army actually offered me, it offered me an early out. Now, during that process, I'm going to back up a little bit. I had actually been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. United States Army ordered into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was in 1984 when they ordered me to come here. And I remember how angry I was about that. I thought they had misdiagnosed me. I thought they were picking on me. And by then I had a master's degree that the Army insisted on me getting, you know, which actually I got it from UVA. You know, they paid for it. So I said, well, if you're going to pay for it, I'm going to UVA, right? And I said, here I am. I'm a decorated Army officer with a war record, master's degree, and you're going to make me come in here with these people. Are you kidding me? I don't belong in there. And when I showed up at that first meeting, I saw, and the name of the meeting, it was Junks and Drunks. It's the name of it. It was in Ocean View. And I looked around, and I saw bums. I saw derelicts. I saw prostitutes. My kind of people, really. But, you know, I wasn't going to let on to that, though. And then I saw guys hugging each other, saying they love each other. I'm like, oh, come on, man. Is that kind of a meeting? So I'm sitting there with this scowl, right, in the back, you know, arms folded. Don't nobody come near me or nothing, right? And this guy came up to me after the meeting, and he just said, you know what? All the stuff you heard that happened to us, you keep doing what you're doing, living like you're living. It's going to happen to you, too. And I pretty much told him where he could put that, you know, and those are words I try not to use today. Every now and again, someone will slip out watching a sporting event or whatever, or in traffic. And you know, I spent the next 7 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous proving that guy right. I went from decorated Army officer to living in the street, which, you know, I felt, you know, well, I was a little higher class than the other guys living in the street because I had a Maytag box, and my Maytag box was insulated, see? So I was a cut above, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, they had regular boxes. I had a Maytag. Insulated. Yeah, I was living large. And, you know, it didn't take long either. You know, in fact, every single time I went back out, not only did it get worse for me, it got worse faster for me. And then the stuff that didn't happen before happened that time, right? Every single time. I got arrested faster. You know, I mean, just, it was like somebody hit a fast forward button or something. And, you know, by the time I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I wasn't putting something in me every couple of hours, I would start getting sick. I'd start seeing things and hearing things that other people didn't see and hear. Now, this is how far gone I was. I thought that that meant I was some kind of a prophet or something because I can see and hear things that others couldn't. I had this special insight, right? That's honestly what I thought. That's exactly what I thought. And I didn't know I was going through withdrawals. I didn't know that. I really didn't. And I finally surrendered, you know, September the 13th, 1991. And that particular day, you know, my sponsor thought it would be a good idea for me to go to the convention, and it was in Hampton that year. And some of the speakers, see, Hollis D. was a speaker that Friday night, and Father Martin spoke that Saturday night. And as a matter of fact, every year up until he passed away, Father Martin would send me a card for my birthday, you know, because he remembered me being that guy, right? That guy, yeah. And one of the running jokes they have in my home group is that whole weekend somebody was following me around with a mop and a bucket, right? Because, I mean, I was in really, really bad shape. I really was. And I remember Hollis sitting down with me, you know, and talking to me and stuff. And, you know, I remember people telling me that I didn't ever have to feel like that again if I didn't want to. Just do a few simple things one day at a time. That seemed a lot easier to me than what the Army had told me in 1984. If you drink and use that stuff anymore, you can't do that for the rest of your life if you want to remain a part of this man's Army, you know. And at that time, I was 26 when they told me that in 1984. The rest of my life seemed like a long time. But at the rate that I was going, it really wasn't. It really wasn't. So the one day at a time thing really, you know, hit home with me. And at the end of that convention, my mother and a family friend took me to the Veterans Hospital in Richmond, which is where I got sober at. And I don't remember a whole lot of after getting there. I remember waking up, strapped down to a bed with two sets of broken restraints, and they told me that I had broken out of them and had beat a couple of people up. I don't remember any of that. Don't remember any of it. And while I was at that hospital there, we'd have these guys come in and bring a meeting into us. And I met these two guys, and they made it clear they didn't like me. I made it clear I ain't like them either. In fact, I didn't like anybody when I got here. I really didn't. And I remember my sponsor telling me the first time that I really want to drink, and I don't, that was going to be a breakthrough for me. And you all had told me things like get numbers, call somebody every day in AA whether you know what to say or not, because that would get me in the habit of picking that phone up and calling people. When it did hit the fan and got all over me, I could call somebody and tell them. And a lot of times, my end of the conversation was, I was told I was supposed to call somebody. You're it. I don't know what I'm supposed to say, right? But that got me into the habit of calling people. And that day came that they talk about in our literature where the only thing between me and picking up that next one is my relationship with God. And one of the first things that we did when I came back in here was I was told to get on my knees and ask God to take the obsession to drink from me. And I had been told that before, but I wouldn't do it. I think I was afraid that it wouldn't work, and I was even more afraid that it would, and I wasn't done yet. And I did that. And when that day came where I wanted to really, I mean, I wanted to get loaded bad. I really did. And I remember praying. And when my eyes opened, I was next to a phone. I guess that was God's way of telling me, call somebody. So I called these two guys that I didn't like, and they didn't like me. And I told them, I said, if I could get a buzz from eating this phone, I would. And it wasn't even 15 minutes. They came and picked me up, took me to a meeting. And they actually took me on a 12-step call with them that night, too. And I had the first new pair of sneakers on my feet that I had in a long time. And the guy that 12-stepped was kicking a non-conference approved substance. He got sick,
and it wound up on my new sneakers. But I didn't drink that day. And I knew right there that that actually worked. So when it happened again, not only did I had a good point of reference, not from what somebody told me, but from something I had actually tried. And it worked. I left the VA in Richmond, and I remember old-timers. I mean, I thought these were some of the meanest old guys I ever met in my life. They would tell me stuff like, boy, something will change on the inside of you and change real fast. You're not going to stay here. And see, back then, they just weren't as politically correct as we are now. You know, they just weren't, you know. You know, my sponsor, he got sober in the second edition of the Big Book. I got sober in the third edition. And these guys, I mean, I was like, man, God, I hate these guys. And I would go boo-hoo to them, telling them how I was feeling, blah, 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 blah. And they would just look at me and, you know, like, well, Wayne, what are you doing? What are you doing? And they're like, oh, man, they don't care about how I feel. They cared. But they cared more about what I was doing than how I felt, because they knew how I felt, like garbage. I was supposed to, you know, because that's pretty much what I dragged in here with me. And I remember going to this sweet blue-haired little old lady and telling her how these old guys were mean to me and stuff. And, you know, I said, you know, they don't care about how I feel. And we called her Mama D. And she just looked at me, you know, and just said in just the sweetest voice, well, sweetheart, I guess you're just going to have to grow some thicker skin because you're going to need it here. I'm like, what? What? I'm thinking she's going to, oh, baby, it's going to be all right. You know, that's what I was looking for. Yeah, she didn't give me that. And she gave me the truth. She gave me the truth. I remember my sponsor and I had a bit of a sense of urgency about me going through the steps, because he knew that I wasn't going to stay, you know, if we hadn't. And, you know, the book talks about that psychic change, you know, that total personality displacement. And I needed one of them real bad. I really did. I really, really did. You know, and some people probably think I still do. But, yeah. Yeah. Okay. anyway, he and I, you know, we went through the steps. And he had me do a lot of writing. And he got me involved in doing things in AA early. Because what he told me was this. He said, because, see, I knew all the stuff in the literature, where it was, what page it was on. I knew that for the 7 years I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, from 1984 to 1991. He said, son, you got what's known as a knew it but wouldn't do it problem. See, you know what to do, but you're just not doing it. And then you're blaming the process for not working. And I did. I mean, this crap don't work. You know, I wasn't working. So he said, here's the plan. This is going to be your mantra. He said, the less you think you know, and the more you actually start doing around here, the better off you're going to be. I wanted to hit him. I really did, but I didn't. As a matter of fact, toward the end of my drinking and stuff, I did what a lot of good AAs do. When the wife had got sick of me, you know, in California, I came back to Virginia and lived with Mom. And she basically laid down the law of, well, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do this. And finally, she had had enough of me. And my sponsor actually told her, put him out. And she did. So I wound up in the street. And I actually sat around plotting ways that I can get him for that and it not be traced back to me. Right? Yeah, that's how sick I was. But anyway, he and I, we sat down and, you know, he took me through the steps and he had me do a whole lot of writing, though. I mean, a lot. I mean, even with the first step, he had me write. And I'm like, wow. But there's something about seeing it on paper. You know, and I remember we got to the second step, you know, believing, you know, God restored me to sanity. And I remember, you know, we talked a lot about faith, right? And I used to think when I got here that my problem was lack of faith. But, you know, thank God for a good sponsor. He said, well, you know, the book says lack of power was our dilemma. Don't say lack of faith. He said, no. He said, well, let me ask you this. When you were shaking that next morning, did you have faith that first one was going to stop you from shaking? I said, well, yeah. He says, okay. When you were doing that other stuff, did you have faith that what the guy was going to bring you back was what you paid him for? And I'm like, well, yeah. He says, what about them bar fights? Did you think he was the baddest dude in there? I said, well, that's probably because I was, but yeah, okay. He says, well, you know what? All of that took faith. Your problem wasn't lack of faith. Your problem was the things you were putting your faith in. That's where we need to change some things. And, you know, he taught me to put my faith in this process, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my God, you know. And he tricked me into service work. I remember he had me cleaning ashtrays. Back then, they were smoking meetings. And I didn't smoke. Well, not cigarettes anyway. And I looked at him, man, why I clean these stupid ashtrays out, man? I don't even smoke. He says, well, you want to stay here this time, don't you? I'm like, well, what do you think? So he just gave me more ashtrays. Guess both our questions got answered, huh? And he was the manager of Clean and Sober Club at that time. And he would come get me from the Veterans Hospital. And that Saturday morning, I would help him clean the club up. So I'm mopping the floor. I'm like, man, why do I have to clean up behind other people? I wasn't even at the dance last night. He says, well, think about how many times people cleaned up behind you. I'm like, yeah, okay. So he gave me fresh mop water. Nice guy. So, yeah. I mean, that's the kind of stuff he would do. And I remember him taking me to this one particular meeting. And I looked around there. I'm like, I looked at him. I'm like, dude, have you lost your mind? Why are you bringing me in here with all these white people, man? I can't relate to them. They can't relate to me. He said, this was my name, too, for the first year or so. Sit down, shut up, and listen. And I'm like, fine. Well, I ain't coming back to this meeting. That's been my home group now. The one I just introduced you to. Yeah, that's my home group. It's been my home group for over 20 years. Yeah. Yeah. Show you how much I know, right? Yeah. When we got to the third step, we actually got on our knees like it is in the big book. It said that third step prayer. And I remember when it came time, you know, for me to do the fourth step, it was kind of daunting to me at first. It was. And he would just say, well, did you really mean business when we did that third step prayer? I said, well, yeah. He says, you know, all we did was made a decision there. The way you follow up and carry out that decision is working the rest of the steps. You know, you want to stay, get busy, right? And, you know, I did that fourth step, and the implied fourth column, you know, the part that I played in a column, I still don't like that column much. I really don't. I really don't. But that was the column that made the difference. I mean, made all the difference, you know, in my life. It really did, because it actually forced me to look at me. And what I learned from that experience is, you know, the biggest obstacle I have to face daily, it ain't God, it ain't the devil, it ain't even other people, as much as I want to blame other people. It's the guy that looks back at me when I look in the mirror. See, if I can overcome him, I can overcome anything. Anything. When it came time to sit down and actually, you know, talk about this stuff in the fifth step, we rode out to the beach. And I'm spilling my guts. You know, and then I'm like, whew, well, glad that's over. And he says, you're not done yet, are you? I'm like, well, yeah. He says, well, no. He says, I haven't heard one single good thing in there. Nothing. And I said, well, I don't know. And, you know, he proceeded to share some things about himself, you know, with me. And I'm like thinking, dude, it's a good thing you got here when you did, right? Boy, you really need me, don't you? Good God. So, yeah, he said, well, didn't you graduate from college? I said, well, yeah, I did, you know. He says, well, don't you have two beautiful daughters? I said, well, yeah. He says, well, you know, let's talk about that, too, because we need something to build on, too. You know, we do. And I had never thought of that. And then once we, you know, finished, I did just like it says in the book. I went home. I sat down in the quiet and whatever, took the book down, you know, actually put it up on a shelf, too, because I wanted to follow everything to the letter. And I took it down, you know, went through the first
proposals to make sure I didn't mix mortar with sand, you know, like it says or whatever, you know. Yeah, and I was a little sarcastic about it, too, just a little bit. And, you know, I did just like it said. When we got to 6 and 7, he essentially told me that this is where we're going to really start to address your behavior, you know, in these steps. And it talks about separating the men from the boys. And, you know, to becoming entirely ready, usually it has to hurt real bad, you know, for me to become entirely ready, you know. But it doesn't have to hurt as much now for me to become entirely ready. And, you know, the 7th step clearly spells it out to me that it's not my job to remove any shortcoming that I have. It's not my job to do that. It is clearly God's job to do that. Now, my job is to actually behave like he's done it, right? Yeah. That's where it gets a little dicey. Yeah. Not hard to do in here with you all because you understand. See, it's when I get in traffic, right, you know, with those idiots. You know, it's when I'm at work and people aren't behaving the way I think they should behave, you know, because the world would be so much better if everyone behaved the way I thought they would, right, you know. There would be no wars or none of that stuff, right? I would be the grand ruler and emperor of the world, you know, and stuff. And I would be a kind ruler. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it just doesn't work that way. Matter of fact, I know it wouldn't work that way now because I'm married, you know. That ain't going to fly. But, you know, when that 7-step prayer is part of my daily, you know, routine. I try to take that with me, you know, everywhere I go. When we got to step 8, you know, we made this list. And, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, each thing on there, which we were able to divide it up into who will be seen first, who will be seen later, and divine appointment, which to me meant I'm getting out of that, right? I ain't got to worry about that. I've had more divine appointments in Alcoholics Anonymous than anything else. I really have. And every time I've gone ahead of what my sponsor told me, I'm like, well, this guy's geographically closer. I should probably go to him first when it came to step 9. Bad idea. Dude chased me out of his office with a gun. Said, woo, maybe I need to come back at another time, right? You know. Okay. Yeah, okay, I'll listen to my sponsor now, right? And, you know, when we going through that, through those amends, I had some really tricky ones on there too. And one of the big things, you know, like a lot of alcoholics, I owed a lot of money. In fact, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was mid-6 figures in debt, right? You know, I had child support people after me from Hawaii and California, and even the Commonwealth of Virginia chimed in, right? And I remember my sponsor telling me, you know, these people are more interested in you paying them than they are about locking your sorry butt up again. So do just like it says in literature. Write letters. Put money in the letters, right? Let them know what it is you're trying to do. Let them know where you're coming from and everything. They probably already know anyway because, you know, a lot of my 5th step had become a matter of public record anyway. So it wasn't no big surprises, right, or nothing. So, yeah. I did what he said. And just like it says in literature, some of the shrewdest debtors, you know, forgave some of the debt eventually when they saw me making a consistent effort. And when I came in here, I was unemployed and unemployable. I was. And this one amends was really bothering me. The guy had died, and no, I didn't have anything to do with that, okay? On the record, I had nothing to do with that, okay? So I remember telling my sponsor about that, and he said, this one's bothering you. I said, yeah, it really is. He said, well, does the guy have a family? I said, well, yeah, he does. Do they celebrate Thanksgiving? I said, yeah, I think they do. He says, well, here's what you're going to do until this doesn't bother you anymore. You're going to buy them a full Thanksgiving dinner. And at this time, I had a barely minimum wage job, right? And I'm like, you know, I don't make it. He says, you know what? If it doesn't cost you something, it's not going to mean anything to you. Just do it. And just watch what happens. So I did that until it didn't bother me anymore. And You know, to this very day, I thank him for having me do that. It took 16 years in Alcoholics Anonymous for me to pay all that mid-six-figure stuff off. You know, it took 16 years in here. And in some of them years, I had to go without a lot of stuff I didn't like, that I liked, you know. But, you know, I wanted to stay. You know, I wanted to stay. And you know, part of, for me anyway, staying is not just being clean outside, but being clean on the inside too, right? And that was part of me cleaning up my act, you know, on the inside. And, you know, the 10th step is something that I, you know, it's one of those ongoing things. I think the key words in there is when we were wrong, which means, yeah, even I'm going to be wrong. You know, continued, which means, oh, it's an ongoing process. Promptly, which means I can't, like, you know, stew on it or sleep on it or whatever. Because even if I'm wrong, well, on the rare occasions when I'm wrong, I can, like, you know, if I let it sit and stew long enough, I will actually find a loophole in there. You know, like the chocolate bunny down to the feet thing or whatever, you know. Bringing home the milk and the bread. No time frame, but I brought it, you know. I will find a loophole. So I need to be real prompt about setting things right. That way I don't give myself enough time to find where I might have been just a little bit right in there. You know, and the 11th step I was taught, you know, in here, you know, the other 10 will keep me from drinking, but the 11th step is the one that will keep me growing. Because that's what keeps the channel clear between me and my God. And see, I can't get anything good in if it's clogged up with garbage. You know, there's no room for it. And I remember telling my sponsor that I don't really know how to meditate, right? And he said, well, let me ask you this. Have you ever held a grudge against anybody? Just sat around brooding over how you going to get back at them? I said, yeah, man, and they had it coming too, right? He says, well, welcome to the wonderful world of meditation. Now we just got to find you something healthy to meditate on, right? Hey, that's why sponsor is so important, because I wouldn't have figured any of this stuff out. You know, and the 12th step, you know, it's living Alcoholics Anonymous. It really is. It really is. And I remember right around 3 years, a guy asked me to sponsor him, and I was still real angry then, and I felt like my head was going to explode. And the guy had actually, he had been in the program 5 years. And I said, well, man, that's not right. 3 and 5. I don't know if I should be able to do this or not. So I went to my sponsor. He said, do it. You know, keep your head from exploding, right? And I said, he says, where is he in the steps? I said, check this out. He hadn't done a 4th step. And the dude had been in here 5 years. How in the world did he do that, right? And he said, yeah, you need to work with him. So when I get back to the guy, he says, what are we going to do first? I said, we're going to get on our knees and thank God you ain't got drunk yet. Dude, how in the world did you do that, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have had some fantastic things happen. And we were talking about it outside earlier. I have to sometimes, like, man, is this really my life? Is it really my life? You know, when I checked into the VA hospital, they did a scan, you know, on my head. And they showed me, you know, the result. They, on one side, they had someone who had had a stroke, right? And then they had mine on the other side. They wouldn't tell me which was which. Now, one of them looked like somebody, he looked a little burnt out, right? The other one looked like somebody had just caught it on fire and let it burn itself out. So I'm thinking, well, since I'm upright and talking, the half-baked one is mine, right? You know, there's no way that ash heap could be mine. And he said, guess again, right? That's the damage I had done to myself by the time I had gotten here. And a few years ago, I actually went back to school and finished up a PhD. And we're a 4.0, right? And it was one of those deals where my job said if I had a 4.0, they would pay for the whole thing. And I'm going to tell you, it was hard. I wanted to cry. Sometimes it was hard. I'm serious. I ain't going to lie to you. It was very difficult. You know, that's just one of the blessings I've gotten. And something that we were talking about outside earlier, too. You know, I didn't think I would ever darken the door of a church again. And so you all told me the same thing. Dude, if you want to get anything out of it, you need to put something into it, right? So,
you know, for the last over 20 years now, I've been a member of the same church, and I play in the band there, and I, you know, help usher God's people in his presence. I do that every Sunday morning that I'm in town. And I would never have imagined I would have done anything like that, ever. I mean, ever. You know, I have two beautiful daughters. I've got two beautiful granddaughters. You know, and my my oldest granddaughter, she's kind of getting that right about that age where she's starting not to be so cute anymore to me. But the youngest one, there's still hope for her yet. I can probably still mold her a little bit. Yeah. And something else really amazing has happened to me since I've been in here. The gentleman that I had mentioned earlier, Hollis, that talked to me my first day back in Alcoholics Anonymous. A few years ago, I was involved in service work in my area. I was the alternate DCM at that time, and this young lady was a GSR in her district. Our circles of service widened and they intersected. So we, and trust me, it wasn't on my radar and it wasn't on hers either. So we started, you know, talking a little bit, ate a little bit. And long story short, Hollis actually did our wedding for us last September, right? So, I mean, that's just another miracle. You know, when I came in here, I had an ex-wife who couldn't wait to get rid of me. And now I actually have a wife who, most of the time, who's actually happy to be married to me, right? Or at least that's what she'll let on as, you know. And I have actually, you know, gotten involved at the area level as well now. And that was something I never dreamed I would be doing, you know. And all of that is thanks to a program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you know, and my God. And actually doing maybe a little bit of work, you know, and stop trying to find loopholes. Because, you know, I still look for them. I do. But I don't look for them as often now, you know. But I want to thank you guys for asking me to do this. It's been a privilege to spend this evening with you. And my goodness, that German restaurant was off the chain. I'm serious. God bless you. Thank you.